So why is it important to study the 1952 Bolivian Revolution? I wanted to start with this rather uninspiring-looking chap. This is General Antonio Salomé Vargas. He's a senior. He was a senior army officer in the junta of General Hugo Bayivian, the military dictatorship that ruled Bolivia at the beginning of 1952. And so late in the afternoon of Tuesday, the 8th of April, 1952, General Salomé left the front entrance of the presidential palace and hurriedly made his way through the cobbled streets of La Paz to the nearby offices of the General Directory of the Police. Salomé was known around La Paz as a man responsible for making constant accusations against the bourgeois nationalist MNR, accusing them of planning a rebellion alongside communist agitators under his watch. And the police carried out constant raids against Trotskyists and the nationalist MNR alike in the working class districts in and around La Paz. The bystanders that would have seen Salomé take this route countless times each day and probably thought little of it. But little did they know, Salomé was in fact finalising the last preparations for a coup d'etat in alliance with a number of middle-ranking officers in the military, heads of the police, fascist gangs, and importantly, the people many believed him to be working against, the bourgeois nationalist MNR. And so the actions of this coup bloc that evening and the following morning would open up a historical process and political contestation between the working class of Bolivia and the old military regime, a historical and political process characterized by some of the most intense and successful urban guerrilla warfare seen in all of the 20th century, with hundreds of thousands of armed workers and peasants at the head of that revolutionary process. And so that process is, of course, the Bolivian Revolution of 1952. And I want to argue it should be seen as one of the great working class rebellions, revolutions and insurrections of the 20th century that deserves greater attention from the tradition that I'm part of, the tradition of socialism from below, primarily for two reasons. Firstly, the depth and scale of the revolution. I think it went further than any of the workers' movements across the Latin American continent and closer to taking power into the hands of workers than any of the other movements in other countries. It did this through defeating and disarming what we call the repressive arms of the capitalist state, the standing army and police, and put decision-making power, how force is to be exercised in society, into the hands of armed workers and peasant militias. And secondly, I think very importantly, for people in this room who are organised revolutionary socialists, it was Trotskyists, the poor as they were called, who played a central role in this revolutionary process and competed for leadership of the working class movement with the bourgeois nationalist MNR. So to do all of this, I need to set the scene of how Bolivian society looked like before the revolution. I need to describe the players that went into the revolution. I need to account for how the revolution broke out, what it achieved, and finally, I need to explain how the revolution was ultimately defeated and what lessons we can draw from this experience. Okay, so firstly, what did Bolivia look like before the revolution? So it was characterized by what Bolivian Trotskyists called combined and uneven development. So on the one hand, you had a very backwards agricultural sector carried over from Spanish colonial rule. Highly unproductive farming estates, known as latifundia, concentrated in the hands of a tiny minority of landowners known as gamonales. So the gamonales identified as white to differentiate themselves from the Indian indigenous, predominantly Aymara and Quechua, descent peasants working beneath them. And so these peasants lived in virtual serfdom at the mercy of these landowners. They performed backbreaking labour through primitive techniques. They had most of what they produced taken away from them, and they were subjected to all sorts of atrocities. You can read about beatings, rape, torture, enslavements and executions in a lot of the mainstream press at the time. And so on the other hand, in the cities and the mountains, there was an advanced modern economy. In the cities, you had small manufacturing, metal and glass works, construction, textiles. But the real blast furnace of the Bolivian economy was up in the mountains, in the tin mines. And these mines produced incredible wealth and power for the capitalists who controlled them. There was just three, in fact, known as the Rosca, which controlled 83% of an industry which accounted for 80% of national exports. They sold their tin to Europe and the United States, who in turn smelted it for them since Bolivia had no smelting facilities. And then the Bolivian state, controlled by politicians, bureaucrats and army generals, all loyal to the Rosca, brought that tin back in the form of weapons and artillery they needed to safeguard their power from the biggest danger, the new Bolivian working class. And so that working class was a new development in history. They were very young, they were very radical, and whilst a minority concentrated in the cities and in the mines, they could potentially exercise immense power, especially the mine workers. So these mine workers, they lived and worked in hellish conditions, high up in the mountains, isolated, living in crowded shanty towns. When they went down into the mines, they faced extreme heat and cold, back-breaking, dangerous work. They had to wield dynamite, picks, heavy perforators, loaded ore into heavy carts and pushed them by hand. Shifts were long and could last for days on end. Accidents were frequent, often deadly. They were given no masks, so they were breathing clouds of dust. Life expectancy was short, and most succumbing to silicosis before the age of 30. And so the spitting of blood was very much a symbol of their plight. I'll go back, actually. These miners understood their place in society. They knew that their labour produced unimaginable wealth for the capitalists, and they began to see themselves as the vanguard of not just the working class in the cities, but the peasantry in the countryside from which most of them originated and maintained crucial links. And importantly, these miners were rebellious, more and more so in the lead up to the revolution. Ruthless violence was necessary to contain them. Mining fields were usually guarded by army barracks, and the army did not hesitate to massacre workers to impose the most brutal discipline when needed. And so to summarise the picture of Bolivia before the revolution, it was a very unstable situation characterised by, on the one hand, an ancient economy, and on the other, a powerful modern economy that were highly integrated into each other, locked into a world market through the profitable tin sector, yet little of these profits would re-enter the economy, and produced a situation of extreme underdevelopment domestically and a state reliant on huge amounts of foreign debt. And so that whole situation is strung together by a viciously racist ruling class and repressive apparatus, totally subservient to the Rosca, the tin capitalists, and the semi-feudal landowners. Okay, so who's going to fix this situation? Well, it's clearly not going to be the capitalists because they're responsible for it. The landlords benefit from it. Peasants want to change, but they lacked the capacity to organise themselves into a class. And the working class was still a minority of the population. So it can seem like an insurmountable situation. But importantly, the last force that goes into the revolution is the revolutionary movement itself, which has three wings, all of which had some connection to the working class. So the first wing were the Stalinists, the Revolutionary Left Party, or the PIA, founded in 1940. And this guy, José Arce, he was one of their chief theoreticians. Him and the group as a whole had a stagist view of revolution. So for them, Bolivia was mostly a feudal society, so the country had to be industrialised so capitalism could develop and the working class could become a majority of the population. And so somewhere in the far distant future, you could have a revolution and establish socialism. So this perspective, though, this stagist set of politics, sees them align with the tin capitalists because, of course, you have to support them because you want to develop the economy and so forth, and their parties as well during the Second World War in what are called Popular Front governments, which actually leaves them politically discredited going to the revolution. I'll go into that a bit later on. And so that discrediting, though, leaves the field open to the two other wings of the revolutionary movement. So they're the bourgeois nationalists, the National Revolutionary Movement, or the MNR, which was founded in 1941. And so they argued what Bolivia needed was a national revolution instead. So what does that mean? Well, if you read any of their documents, they're highly vague about what this project entails. They combine anti-imperialist rhetoric, patriotic, even socialist terminology with a political program that calls for national independence and various trade union rights. And the people who make up this party are mainly drawn from the middle class. So dissident military officers, lawyers, doctors, intellectuals. They have no real connection to the peasantry. Importantly, though, they maintain a connection to the working class through control over sections of the trade union bureaucracy, particularly in the mining unions. And their main orientation, the main orientation of the MNR, is toward capturing the Bolivian state, often through military means, violence and coups that were mentioned at the start. So the third force going into the revolution is, of course, the Trotskyists. So this is the Revolutionary Workers' Party, the POR, or the POR, founded in 1935. And what the POR argue is that Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution applies to Bolivia. And so what that means is that the Bolivian working class, small as it was, even though it was a minority, had the capacity to establish itself as the leadership of all oppressed classes and create a workers' state through the destruction of the old capitalist state. And importantly, they saw the race question as being central to that. The majority of the population are indigenous, they suffer racial oppression, but they also form the majority of the working class as well. And I don't have time to go into it, but if you read some of the initial figures in the Trotskyist movement, I think it's quite pioneering a lot of their work on the indigenous question. And so the POR argue that the nationalist forces of the MNR will not be able to carry out the task of a coming revolution, which involves universal suffrage for the majority of the population, the nationalisation of the mines, and land redistribution for the peasants. And so this idea of permanent revolution and the politics that flow from it is a very, very powerful idea, primarily amongst students and sections of workers, in particular mining workers. And through small study circles, building small propaganda groups on university campuses, supporting strikes of mine workers and what have you, the Trotskyists are able to establish somewhat of a base in amongst the student movement and amongst the workers' movement, and in particular as well in the Cochabamba Valley region, which I'll go into why that's important a bit later on. But I think their perspective also leads them into forming alliances with left trade union officials connected to the nationalists, who they believe they could split and win them over to their side because their party is not able to carry out the tasks of the revolution they think that they're supposed to be, achieving. Okay, so you have the Stalinists, you have the nationalists, and you have the Trotskyists. So there's three forces that go into the revolution. So how did the revolution actually begin? I think it doesn't just begin in 1952. It's actually the culmination of a very long historical process that lasts a couple of decades, in fact, which leads to the breakdown of that ruling class block of the Rosca, the land, like the tin capitalists, the gobernadores, the landlords, and the old capitalist state. So the first historical process is war, the Chaco War, which is fought between Bolivia and Paraguay over the oil-rich and strategically important Chaco region. So there's one description of a soldier, I think he's a middle-ranking officer, in the war that described it as a green hell. So it's like one of the most densely black jungle regions around in Latin America. And, you know, there's all sorts of disease and mosquitoes, all that sort of stuff, deadly other animals, snakes. But the mass mobilizations involved in this war effort, combined with the mass slaughter and the inhumanity of the war itself, they actually killed tens and tens of thousands of people in a country that's not very big, led to quite an intense radicalization. And so there was an anti-war sentiment that combined with resistance to conscription, strikes, demonstrations, and even mutinies in the army. I don't have much time to go into in detail, but if that might be something comrades want to pick up on the discussion. But that radicalization leads to the second important historical process, which popular accounts call this military socialism. So these two guys, Colonel David Toro and German Busch, were quite representative of this political phenomena. So military socialism, what does that refer to? I think you can see it as quite similar to in other parts of like the third world or former colonial nations where sections of like the military often involved in building up the economy and capitalist state, because there's no unified bourgeoisie that's able to compete on a, you know, on a global scale. And so this state building project of military socialism, it's led by dissident sections of the military that have been radicalized by the war. And their project's about stabilizing Bolivian capitalism in the face of that radicalization I just described. So they do this through nationalizing the oil sector to stimulate domestic growth. They attempt to integrate and in some cases build various trade union bureaucracies to help them run different parts of the economy. And you see a similar process happen under Perón in Argentina around the same period as well. But they're unable to solve the underlying economic crisis and political instability, leading to a series of coups, assassinations, and, you know, various other forms of violence led by the openly capitalist parties. So the third historical process I think that's important to grasp is the Second World War and the Popular Front governments that I alluded to before. So this is a complex period of history, so I'll only be brief about it, but I think there's three important points to note about it. Firstly, that the Stalinists are destroyed as a political force within the workers' movement during this period. So as I alluded to earlier, the logic of their Popular Front and class collaborationist politics leads them to uniting with openly reactionary forces and backing a whole series of repressive measures against the working class movement. So they unite with the tin capitalists and capitalist parties to overthrow one of the military socialist regimes in 1946. And they actually oversee brutal massacres of workers whilst in government with the capitalist party. So there's one famous massacre where, the head of labor, the Department of Labor, is a member of the Stalinist party, and they order the military to gun down people, and then they get the Communist Party to just hunt down nationalist trade unionists in what's quite, you know, you think about fascism, it has quite similar dynamics to things that happened in Germany and other places like that, with gangs of, people running riot and smashing up workers' organisations. That's what the Stalinist party was involved in doing during that period of government. The second point that's important about this historical period is that the alliance of the Trotskyists and left trade union officials connected to the bourgeois nationalists is consolidated in this period. And you can see that in two of their political interventions. One of them is the thesis of Pulakaya and the other is the miners' parliamentary bloc. So to get an idea of what the thesis of Pulakaya about. Imagine if, like, the CFMEU adopted a revolutionary program and its statement of principles was based on Trotsky's theory of permanent revolution. That's basically, if you read it, you should read it if you haven't yet. It's quite an exercise in left cover, I would say. So in theory, the Trotskyists thought they were winning workers to the program of permanent revolution. But rather than winning political independence of the working class, they're in fact building the trade union wing of the nationalists and giving left credentials to those officials that were involved in it. And so connected to that, those theses was the creation of a miners' parliamentary bloc. So this was a coalition of various Trotskyist militants and nationalist trade union officials to intervene into parliament. And so whilst the bloc is able to carry out, you would say, like, quite serious mass agitational work and boost extra parliamentary struggles, it's quite an uptick in strikes during this period, it's really the nationalists who gain the most out of the alliance, and the Trotskyists just increasingly make themselves indistinguishable from the left union officials, which is a very important dynamic going into the revolution. So the third point I think that's important to grasp about this period is that the bourgeois nationalists consolidate themselves as the main revolutionary alternative to the Roscoe-aligned regime. And so they do this through a combination of parliamentary manoeuvres, so the parliamentary miners' bloc is obviously one of them, but also a series of failed coup attempts in the aftermath of one of those massacres of mine workers. So there was a massacre at a mine called Siglo XX, where it's estimated that anywhere between 200 to up to 2,000 people were gunned down by machine guns, and that, you know, it's one of these incidents that the head of the the Labor Department of the government at the time is, you know, a Communist Party member. So the Nationalists run in elections shortly afterwards and win the presidency, but in response to that, the government declares a state of emergency and installs a military junta, which sets the stage for the revolution. Okay, so how did the revolution break out? So as I alluded to in the introduction, I think there are two dynamics that are going on that are important to grasp. The first is from above. So this failed coup attempt by the Nationalists. So the coup wasn't intended to be a popular uprising. It was basically planned to be carried out by a tiny section of the police, or, you know, the majority of the police, the military officers, Nationalist cadre, and even fascist gangs, under the direction of that uninspiring chap I alluded to at the start, General Salome, with absolutely no popular involvement whatsoever. But as, you know, uninspiring as he was, General Salome and the coup bloc, they completely fucked the whole situation up. So they think they have mass support within the army for their coup, and they basically get onto the radio first thing in the morning and say, "We're carrying out a coup, and we're the new government," before actually seeing if they've got all of the different sections of the army units on their side. And so after they've captured major public positions or buildings in the capital of La Paz, you know, the bad news for them is the army high command knows that they don't have mass support. And within hours, there's, you know, very, very intense street fighting, you know, with almost the entirety of the armed forces involved in the streets of La Paz. And their forces, the forces of the coup bloc, they quickly crumble, and it looks almost certain the military is going to cling onto power. But it doesn't stop there. So there's obviously another dynamic that comes into play, which is from below. So the mass insurrectionary struggle of workers and then by peasants in the countryside later on. And so I think what's released in response to this botched coup and, you know, the attempt to overthrow the old regime is some of the most intense street fighting and urban warfare to be waged by a working class movement in the 20th century, comparable perhaps to, you know, the Spanish Civil War or, you know, the 1956 uprising in Hungary. So it starts in the factories and construction sites of La Paz. Militants in those workplaces, some of them Trotskyists, some of them Nationalists, are quick to hear the fighting and soon join. Soon, groups of armed workers, many of whom had served in the Chaco War and still had their guns, are mobilised from most of the major factories and begin building barricades all throughout the city as the army prepares for a fierce bombing campaign on all of their positions. Yeah. So, you know, the radicalisation then spreads to the mining centres, so Potosi, Oruro and Maluni. And miners armed with dynamite and Chaco-era rifles capture key military barracks in these cities or, you know, towns, mining centres, supplying them with more weapons and winning the lower ranks of the army to their side. In Oruro, I can't find any photos of it or any video, which is a shame, but they actually marched the captured army generals and officers through the town in their underwear, and apparently, like, you know, everyone's having a go at them, throwing shit at them. Yeah, and they lock them up in the prison and release all the political prisoners. And in Maluni, the miners of Maluni, just think of La Paz is under siege. You know, there's the army have a whole bunch of artillery that they're bombing certain working class districts, and just tens and tens of thousands of miners come down from up in the hills and basically, you know, armed with all sorts of things, dynamite. You know, they've captured various, like, cannons and various things and just totally pulverise the military and lead to seizing more military arsenal. There's a famous case of, you know, a bunch of workers just driving a bunch of trucks down a hill into a military barracks and jumping out and completely destroying the barracks and, you know, capturing all the weapons in there and what have you. And so that explosion from below was so tremendous that within a few days the standing army had been effectively completely defeated and armed workers had captured the presidential palace. And so that revolutionary process, as I mentioned earlier, then spreads to the countryside throughout the year. Land sieges by peasants who soon form their own militias themselves, and in some places, such as the Cochabamba Valley, where the Trotskyists have a following, they begin collectivising the land. And so in those days, workers created institutions that expressed their power and remained in place for many years to come. So firstly, there are the militias, the armed groups of workers organised in every workplace. So who commanded them? It varied from workplace to workplace, depending on the level of pre-existing organisation. But in some cases, it would be the most authoritative workers. In some cases, it would be union delegates. In some cases, it would be union officials. In some places, these militias would fuse with a command structure over the production process and took over whole towns. This is what happened in many of the mining centres. All of the managers and foremen fled for their lives during the uprising, and so the workers through their militias end up controlling and coordinating the basic functions of the town. Like, so they, you know, they basically run the whole show, both economically and politically. Secondly, in order to centralise all of these structures, workers created another institution, the Central Obrero Boliviana, or the COB as it's known. So how did the COB work? I think it's important to understand the COB in its early iterations compared to what it is today. It's more than being more than just a trade union federation. It had under its control its own armed forces. So those militias, both the workers' militias and the peasant militias, were accountable to this institution. In some places, it was coordinating whole towns and workers' control over the production process. And it also included a series of popular associations, which, although they called themselves unions, were not strictly speaking like unions. So tenants, housewives, students and peasant organisations were all affiliated to the body, although representation was weighted in the COB to ensure that the working class organised as it was through trade unions and militias were the majority within the institution. And so through this body, they would debate the goals and the aims of the revolution. So what were the aims and goals, the demands of the COB? So there were two main goals of demands, I'd say, that would arise out of the two main social classes that made up the revolution. On the one hand, there was the nationalisation of the mines under workers' control and land to the peasants and the breakup of the old land boards. And the existence of the COB made workers' power and the implementation of those demands possible, because it's a way for the exploited and oppressed to make decisions collectively, or at least potentially. But obviously, that's not the only set of institutions that are created during the revolution. And the third, significant institution that's created is the nationalist government of Victor Paz and Helen Sears. It's more peasant issues. Yeah, thanks, guys. So this is a small, completely unelected group of politicians that have played no role in overthrowing the military junta. In fact, they were initially hostile to the popular uprising, and they tried to negotiate a power-sharing deal with the generals after their pathetic coup attempt failed. But when they realised they couldn't do that, and obviously the military generals thought they were a bit of a joke, they declared that they were the leaders of the revolution. They celebrated its success. And they were to assume complete responsibility for it. So what you have here in this situation is what you would call one of dual power. On the one hand, the armed workers and peasant militias coordinated through the COB, and then on the other, the nationalist government of Paz and Sears. And so these two institutions exist very uneasily side by side for some number of years. And in most revolutionary situations, one has to take control or eliminate the other. But in the early days of the revolution, I would say it was clearly the workers and sections of the peasantry that held real power through the COB. When you think about it, there's no capitalist army or police that exists anymore. It's just armed workers and peasants. That's the capitalist state has been completely smashed. But then, obviously it raises the question of who takes control of this situation. Because it's not enough to just say that because you have the existence of armed workers and peasants that politics doesn't matter and political leadership, because in many respects it's already the nationalists who are controlling the situation. So if you take a look at the militias, many of these are led by trade union officials connected to the nationalists. The most authoritative of them, the Comando Obrero, which is made up of miners, factory and construction workers, are under the command of the mine workers union leader, Juan Lechin. And it was they who stormed and captured the presidential palace, allowing Paz and Sierz to form their nationalist government. So whilst Trotsky has participated in these militias too, but they're always almost always as individuals, indistinguishable in word and deed from the nationalists that they had formed alliances with in the preceding period. And where the militias were under the command of Trotskyists, they simply behaved in effectively the same way that the nationalists did. So if you take a look at the COG, for the first year of the revolution, the forces between the nationalists and the Trotskyists were relatively even, at least in a numerical sense. But from its highest positions amongst the executive at the top, all the way down to the rank and file militants on the ground, Trotskyists held key positions and commanded enormous authority in the institution. But in practice, the Trotskyists were far from an intransigent opposition. So whilst they occupied a series of important positions within the body, at no point did they operate or even meet as a coordinated fraction to carry out systematic work. And worse still, many of them became advisors and speechwriters for officials like Lechin and other nationalist figures. And so, as I mentioned earlier, this was a political practice that had developed over the years within their trade union work. So in the minds of these Trotskyists, they thought they were winning the officials to their perspective and using them to promote their ideas, but in reality, they were helping subordinate the working class to these trade union officials. I think this is most starkly illustrated when the Trotskyists celebrated the entry of worker ministers into the MNR government. So these were trade union officials who were taking up posts in that provisional government that's been set up. And they argued that the participation of them was a step closer to transforming the nationalist government into a, quote, workers and peasants government. And so instead of building the perspective I think they should have been building, which is all power to the COG, the main line of the Trotskyists became, quote, complete control of the state by left wing of the nationalists. Okay, so did the nationalist government actually deliver on the demands of the revolution? So let's take a look at the question of the mines. The COG demanded the immediate nationalisation without compensation under workers' control of the entire mining industry. But in practice, if you consider what was going on, the militias already had many of the mines under their control, and in some places they controlled, you know, a state apparatus to some extent when they took over the towns. But instead of ratifying what already existed in practice, the government set up a commission of inquiry into nationalisation and made sure the trade union officials participated in it to give the commission legitimacy. And so in turn, the ROSCA, the tin capitalists, they received full compensation, basically locking the Bolivian state into debt repayments for decades. Instead of workers' control, the old management structure was replaced with a system of workers' participation. And so whilst in the short term, the miners received substantial benefits and improvements in pay and conditions, they proved sufficient to maintain their loyalty to Lechin and undermine the influence of the Trotskyists. You know, this situation couldn't last forever, and I'll go into what happens once it collapses. So if you take a look at the question of the land, the other key question of the revolution, in practice, sections of the peasantry had already seized land from the landlords and distributing that land amongst themselves and in some cases brought it under their collective control, such as in the Cochabamba Valley. In response, though, the government set up another commission inquiry that co-opted large sections of the peasant militias into structures controlled by the nationalists, but then terrorised and murdered those controlled by any oppositional forces, such as the Trotskyists. So the Agrarian Reform Law of August 1953, after another four-month commission of inquiry, simply legalised what the peasants had already carried out in practice, made every effort to provide compensation to former landowners in the process, and it gave legal guarantees to any remaining large estates that safeguarded them against expropriation through force. So I think these processes help you understand how the revolution was ultimately defeated. It's a process of emptying out the revolution of its real content, leading to growing disillusionment and to the bureaucratization of the revolutionary institutions that were created in 1952. So if you take a look at the COB, after the nationalisation and land reform decrees had been passed, Lechen and the Nationalists decided that the Trotskyists could be now dispensed with. They launched a campaign against them, they drive them out of the trade unions, and they were successful in that, that effort. So in turn, the COB was then filled with more and more trade union bureaucrats loyal to the Nationalists and increasingly integrated into the capitalist state through the nationalisation of the mines. And that process effectively drove the Trotskyists into a faction fight and a split over the course of 1954 to 55. So there was a debate that had opened up about whether the opportunity for a working class seizure of power had in fact passed and whether the party should recognise this. Now, obviously, it's a, what's the next question? What's the next step forward? And so there was a variety of factions that emerged, dividing themselves between those that supported entering the Nationalists and attempting to transform its left wing into a revolutionary group and those that rejected that perspective. So, what happens is basically it's a split. A whole bunch, like the majority of the core, enter the MNR in this attempt to transform it, and it, you know, basically destroys the organisation. It's not completely destroyed, it lives on, but you'd have to say, like, the majority of its cadre are lost to this bourgeois nationalist party and government. And that splintering bureaucratisation of all the institutions of the revolution meant that the government could eventually go on the counterattack. So if you look at the key question, the repressive arms of the state, the army is then re-established and rebuilt over a number of years into a formidable force through, you know, reintegrating the peasant militias into an army structure. All of the, you know, the working militias are emptied of any revolutionary content. And eventually this leads to, you know, a very serious assault on the working class in the 60s. If you take a look at the question of the Bolivian economy within the global capitalist system, a series of austerity packages drawn up jointly by the Nationalist government and the US Treasury were carried out against the miners, who became increasingly isolated as a political force, leading to a series of massacres and crushing defeats at the hands of a newly reconstituted military. And these combined processes laid the groundwork for the replacement of the Nationalists by a new right-wing military dictatorship that took power in a coup in 1964. And if anyone knows anything about the history of Bolivia in the 60s, it's actually Che Guevara who went in. This was the final campaign that he tried leading in a guerrilla war against this new reconstituted military, completely quite demoralised working class. I think it was political suicide. So to sum up, what can we learn from the Bolivian experience? Well, first, I think the Bolivian experience shows us that workers have the ability to create institutions that can potentially become the basis for a new way of organising society. In the case of Bolivia, it was the militias, and in some cases, the fusion of those militias with control over the production process and the creation of a new state apparatus. The attempt to spread and coordinate that power through the COB, and whilst in many respects those processes didn't go beyond the parameters of what the trade unions and their leaders were willing to tolerate, it did demonstrate the collective power of the working class to defeat and almost entirely destroy a powerful and hated military and police apparatus. I think, secondly, the Bolivian experience shows us the role of reformists and trade union officials as the grave diggers of any revolution, and how to understand orienting towards them. So every moment, the actions of the trade union officials are about limiting the self-activity of the workers and peasants that went on to lay the basis for the demoralisation and defeat of the revolution. So when the trade union leaders were leading militias and fighting the military in the streets and in the mountains, all of that activity was subordinate to the goal of getting politicians and bureaucrats and their party control over what remained of the capitalist state. I think that leads to the third important lesson from the Bolivian experience, is the need for a particular type of revolutionary organisation able to challenge and defeat the reformists. So even though they were small, the Trotskyists had influence in the COB, but their lack of clarity about the role of the left union leaders in particular and the poor's commitment to support part of conditional support for the nationalist government meant that they did very little to build independent forces around the perspective of all power to the COG. So the result was both political and organisational subordination to reformism. It was precisely for all of their mistakes that the Bolivian Trotskyists deserve serious study. They were able to build their group from a tiny nucleus of anti-war activists, students in particular, and some young workers into the main political current that vied for leadership among the workers and peasantry against the nationalists. I think alongside Vietnam and Sri Lanka, it's one of the few places in the world where Trotskyists became a serious near-dominant force on the left, surpassing the Stalinists in the 20th century. So I'd like to finish, I think, with a quote from an Argentinian Trotskyist, Liborio Justo, whose study of the Bolivian Revolution is widely considered to be one of the key Marxist texts on the topic. Unfortunately, it's not available in English. But it gives you a sense, I think, at the time of what the different historical trajectory of the 1950s could have been opened up by a successful workers' revolution, the creation of a workers' state in Bolivia. If you think about the 50s, you have the USSR, you have the 56 revolution in Hungary, first serious anti-Stalinist revolution. You also have the Cuban Revolution, which very much consolidates guerrilla warfare as the main strategy on the left across Latin America. I think this quote sums up the sort of different historical possibility that could have been opened up by a successful workers' insurrection and workers' state in Bolivia. And so he writes, the proletariat of the Altiplano, headed by the miners, the ruins left from the Incan Empire, the serfs of the colonies, the beasts of burden of the Republic, for the first time in the history of our continent, the vanguard of the proletariat of Latin America had taken power and placed themselves ideologically at the very vanguard of the world proletariat. I think that's why it's important to study this revolution, because of, you know, the tradition that it represents of potentially a socialism from below, different historical possibilities and all the lessons that we can learn from, you know, the success, both the successes and the failures of the Trotskyists in that movement. Thanks.